Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 25, Literary Alchemy and the Mythic Context, where we will be talking with Evan Willis about classical myth and alchemical symbolism in Harry Potter, Cormoran Strike, and Fantastic Beasts. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
I'm feeling great. It's a beautiful, you know, week we've been having here in Oklahoma, and I'm very excited about this conversation. I mean, I've been wanting to speak to for you. I've corresponded with him since 2015, but it's such a delight to have him on. So let's get to him.
Yes, let's just get right to it. Our special guest today is Evan Willis, a graduate of Hillsdale College with degrees in philosophy and mathematics, and now a philosophy graduate student at the University of Dallas. One of the writers at Hogwarts Professor, Evan has taught geometry at the Classical Academy in Colorado Springs, and has his own blog at letthesethingsbe.blogspot.com. Welcome to the show, Evan.
Glad to be here. Hi.
Hi, Evan. I'm preparing myself to get a good education today because we're going to hear not only about literary alchemy, but all of the things that you're doing in the sort of classical era to bring mythology into those similar ideas. So I think John and I are both really excited to hear all of your insights. So John, let's just start with the kind of literary alchemical readings that you have done of Harry Potter. And just for our listeners, we talk about literary alchemy a fair amount here and there, but I always think it is helpful to have a little review at the beginning of class. So John, could you remind us, what is literary alchemy and why should readers be aware of this way of thinking about literature?
Okay. Boy, thank you for this, Katie, because when you talk about literary alchemy, there's three things you've really got to get clear that you're talking about and you're not talking about. First is just alchemical literature, and that's the stuff that was written by actual metallurgical alchemists, the guys trying to change lead into gold and get the elixir of life off that philosopher's stone. And that alchemical literature we have largely due to the efforts of a very famous psychoanalyst named C.G. Jung. He became intrigued by the work of the alchemists. He had his own theory about what they were doing. I happen to disagree with it, but I'll tell you what, I'm really grateful that Jung, in the early parts of the first half of the 20th century, became consumed by it because he gathered all of this material from Eastern European sources that would have been that along with other things of that period, you know, as an historian, really the Second World War continues for 10 years in Central Europe, really, as the Soviets, you know, claim their satellite states. And so that this medieval and largely Christian civilization was eradicated and it just disappeared. We don't have those sources anymore.
You're right.
And that alchemical literature has been preserved, providentially or for whatever, by Jung. And in that we see all these bizarre symbol sets they use to describe what they at least superficially are describing as metallurgical things. You know, this is chemistry in the laboratory about changing one state of matter into another state of matter with a largely sacred context. Now, that's alchemical literature, all right? When you use the phrase literary alchemy, that's my abbreviation, my catchphrase abbreviation for what Stanton Linden, wonderful academic who wrote Dark Hieroglyphics, Alchemy in English Literature from Chaucer to the Restoration. He was the editor of the academic journal called Cauda Pavonis, which is really about literary uses of alchemy. When I say literary alchemy, understand Stanton Linden's phrase there, the literary uses of alchemy. That is that these glyphs and symbol sets that the alchemists used in their literature were used by, and Linden's most interested in English literature, you know, again, from Chaucer really to our times. That use is, especially in Chaucer, Shakespeare, metaphysical poets, and then, you know, really up to our times, especially with the Inklings and such, they use these symbol sets to describe a process of change inside their own books. Francis Yates says that that inside Shakespeare's globe, they had astrological and alchemical glyphs on the upper seats. You could always see this symbolism inside the place, but you didn't need to see it actually in the theater because Shakespeare himself embeds these images inside the plays so that as the changes are happening, you're getting a subconscious or just barely conscious infusion of these alchemical things that Shakespeare recognized that, and this is the next thing. So you've got alchemical literature, that's what alchemists used, and they're talking about, you know, the laboratory. Then you've got the literary uses of alchemy where writers are using these glyphs and symbol sets inside their books. And it's why you've got, you know, that black, white, and red are the colors inside Shakespeare's because black, white, and red are the three stages of alchemy. That leads us to the third thing you've got to get, and the hardest thing to get, I think, really, is the alchemy of literature. This is why writers use these alchemical glyphs and colors in their stories and poetry, is that the act of reading or watching a live performance, this is different than a movie, you know, it really involves a suspension of disbelief to use Coleridge's phrase. And by disbelief, I'm talking about critical discernment, you know, that you turn off your critical faculties and you have to enter into it imaginatively. When you're reading a story, you're sitting there, usually sitting, maybe you're walking around, reading a book. But you're not thinking, here I am reading a book. You're thinking about Harry, Ron, and Hermione, you know, trying to get to the mirror of Erised in the Philosopher's Stone. I mean, you're right there with them.
Right. You're into it. You're into it. Right. Your whole head is in it. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, that's true also when you're watching a play. You're not sitting there thinking, this is not really a stage set where, you know, Rosmer is fighting with Rebecca West. You know, this is I'm there in Norway wondering about the, you know, who's going to win this thing and who killed Rosmer's wife. You know, that imaginative engagement and that critical, you've hit the critical off switch. That entry into the story by the reader means his or her identification with the story characters, and there's an elision of experience with them. So this, you know, Aristotle talked about this ages ago as your catharsis or purification by trial. As Oedipus has his epiphany, oh my gosh, I killed my dad and loved my mom. You know, that the audience is saying, oh my gosh, did I kill my dad and love my mom? You know, you're having that experience right alongside him. That alchemy of literature, that this there's always a chasm. You know, the central human challenge is I'm here sitting behind my eyeballs, and I can't figure out what's going on behind Katie's eyeballs out there or Evan's eyeballs. There's a subject object chasm. I can't get, you know, what, or even just the desk I'm sitting at. You know, what do I have in common with this desk? And in our age, really, we live in the empiricist age. That chasm is set as absolute. Story tells us, no, it's not, because you can have an elision of subject and object, not only in the alchemical laboratory, and that's largely what the alchemists are looking at, self-purification as they purify lead into gold, by their identification with the process. So in literature, the alchemy of literature is that I allied with the subject of the stories, and I am transformed by it.
As the characters are undergoing an alchemical transformation that's being referenced with these symbols, that is also affecting a transformation in us as the reader.
That's right. You pinned it, all right? And the reason that people like Shakespeare and Chaucer and others use this imagery is they understand the alchemy of literature, and they say, well, why don't we use this language, all right?
Now, let me just ask you, is this something that we have to be aware of happening, right? Do we have to already know the alchemical symbols and all of that in order for us to be transformed? Or is this working on us whether we know it or not?
Obviously not, right? Because, when I first started talking about the literary alchemy of Harry Potter in 2002, I was laughed at. I mean, people, first of all, it was just because of the misogyny involved. They were like, oh yeah, Rowling is using stuff like Shakespeare. This lady on the dole who's writing kids' books is a second Shakespeare, right? But there was also just the sense of, you got to be kidding me. What are you talking about? I mean, it requires a worldview, and this is really where Evan's insights are really important about the four levels of reading and myth. It requires a worldview which is absolutely contrary to the spirit of our age, and especially with the academy. I mean, if you read critical literature on Harry Potter, and there's a boatload of it, right? It's all biographical, historical, psychological, sociological, Marxist, feminist, reader response, archetypal, structuralist, deconstructive, cultural studies. You know, all of these things are not so much literary criticism as they are critical attitudes, where people bring tools to the text that they're going to litmus strip these. They learned something when they were in grad school, and they're going to how to use this tool. They basically went to a trade school and learned how to work certain bits of machinery, and they're going to bring that machinery to play in their interpretation of the books. Instead of looking at the books and saying, "Hey, these are intelligently crafted works. These are deliberately constructed things. What do they tell us? What tools that we should bring to them?" What Evan has done is he's saying, "Look, how can you miss the mythic content? You got a guy with a scar here that's obviously an Orestes figure out of Euripides and Aeschylus." I mean, and then that opens the door to an entirely mythological and alchemical understanding of the books.
Right, and I think John, one of the things that you're talking about, like I like the way that you framed it as a critical attitude. And people make meaning with texts all the time. And what you're doing is you're kind of trying to stay internal to the text, and what is the text trying to tell us, and how is the text itself operating on us. And not so much like, what do I bring to the text, but what is the text, doing to me? Which is, I think it's such an interesting way to view it, that really uplifts the text itself. And I'm really interested to turn this maybe to Evan now. Tell us a little bit about why it's valuable to examine literary alchemy within particularly a mythic context. And maybe a little bit how this is different from the kind of alchemical analysis that John has been talking to us about.
One of the things that I was finding, having practiced enough of seeing these symbols of literary alchemy, I then was reading these ancient mythological texts and noticing definitely seems that we have some of the same patterns going on here. And so it was a matter of applying those methods back in a way. So one of the first things that led me in the direction of seeing a root of literary alchemy pre-Renaissance was looking at a text you actually find in Isaac Newton, well within the alchemical literature, in which he's reading Homer and interprets Homer metallurgically. So there's this there's this fascinating scene in the Odyssey where the god Hephaestus is trying to trap Aphrodite, his wife, in bed with Ares, and publicly shame them once they once he finds them. And so he designs this bed that's designed to transform into a net. And so before much time has passed, you have Ares and Aphrodite trapped in this net with a fairly tense situation. Apollo and Hermes show up, begin joking. This rather resolves the tension somewhat, and the gods resolve it as well as they can. But the associated metal with Ares is Mars is iron. The associated metal with Aphrodite is copper. Newton found that there was an alloy of iron and copper that possessed a crystalline structure that looked almost exactly like a net.
And so he's making the connection to the story.
And so he's making the connection to the story to the metallurgical process. I suppose what I'm saying is less that literary alchemy is the foundational bit that predates any metallurgical aspect, but that even prior to Homer, we have at least some of the metallurgical aspects that is being applied.
Wow, that's really interesting. I mean, you think, I mean, Homer, that's pretty, that goes back a long way. So to have that.
Yeah, I suspect that there's some of these symbolisms that are fairly innate, but alchemy more broadly in this earlier context is seen as a reconciliation of opposites. John had mentioned the subject-object distinction. We often also get the, and almost more centrally, the form versus matter distinction in Plato and Aristotle as opposites that need to be united. And so the question becomes, how do you bring about that reconciliation? And the answer tends to be, in the symbolism, by incorporating a glue, some unifying thing that you barely notice, some third thing that bridges the two and unites them, that acts as a catalyst for the whole process. So in literary alchemy, as we see it through Shakespeare, etc., we have sulfur and quicksilver, the form and the matter of the metal that is then divided, purified, and reunified into a more perfect structure, thereby transforming lead into gold or impure substance into pure substance, or internally divided at war with itself substance into pure substance. But behind this, you have a third principle, mercury, which acts as the hidden thing that does the dividing, that does the purifying and does the unifying, all behind the scenes so that you don't notice it. So mercury is the glue between quicksilver and sulfur.
And is mercury, like, is that generally whenever we're looking for something that's about the union of opposites in alchemical literature or mythic readings, mercury is what then we're going to be trying to look for?
Exactly. Exactly. Michael Ward, in his book, Planet Narnia, in analyzing the whole series talks about Lewis's idea of a kappa element in the literary text, which is a sort of hidden layer of meaning that structures the rest. So in the Narnia books, astrological symbolism is the core of that. Each book structured around the typical characteristics of one of the seven medieval planets. Rowling's work features a lot of this alchemical stuff, or more generally, hermetic stuff.
Right, and now Hermes is kind of the Greek corollary to Mercury, is that right? Mercury being the Roman?
Hermes is the equivalent of Mercury. And so the core idea here is the whole of alchemical symbolism, and for that matter, astrological symbolism, numerological symbolism, and ultimately hand symbolism sets, not least of which is the tarot, are grounded in the mythological characteristics assigned to Hermes. Hermes being the, as it were, literary embodiment of this kappa element, this hidden element.
Right, and you've talked about Hermes as representing, I just love this phrase that you use, the present power of the seemingly absent. And so there's this idea that you've got some sort of hermetic figure or force working behind the scenes, maybe to create this bridge. Let's talk a little bit more about the Hermes archetype, particularly at work in Harry Potter. Where do we see that? Why is his figure so important? What is this present power of the seemingly absent, and where might we see that in Harry Potter?
In the Narnia books, place where this is most evident is in Horse and His Boy, where you have Aslan acting behind the scenes, uniting Shasta and Erebus, dividing them, ensuring that messages get from place to place, but you don't see Aslan at all acting throughout the surface level of the text. But if you've read the other books, you know those aspects, being a lion, etc., that signify that Aslan is acting, so that you're not as surprised as Shasta is at the end when he discovers that Aslan's been behind absolutely everything.
One of the things that you mentioned in a paper that you shared with me is the idea that because you've read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you as the reader have a sense that Aslan is maybe behind some of these things, but that if you haven't read that first, you wouldn't necessarily notice the power that's acting in absentia there.
Exactly. It's kind of like learning how to read in general. We're faced with this page of indecipherable glyphs that just hide whatever it is we're supposed to be learning. And then we learn what each of those individually mean, and from that we can gain an understanding that we wouldn't have had otherwise. So this is the alchemy of literature that John is mentioning. You hide it from the conscious so that you can better affect both the human being and bring about knowledge. In the case of reading, bring about spiritual change in your readers, as Shakespeare often did. In Harry Potter, what we want to look for is a figure that forces together opposing elements to try and bring about the change that is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do this behind the scenes and will kind of dwell in the shadows. We're not going to be terribly sure about what this character is up to throughout. The most obvious character for this is Snape.
And I guess you've also kind of noted that Hermes is not always, like, obviously, it's not like Aslan. It's not like, obviously, a good character always doing good things. There are elements of mischief as well, and it can be hard to tell where that force is coming from. And so Snape, as this ambiguous figure, actually makes a really interesting Hermes archetype.
Right. So books 5, 6, and 7, all three climaxes of those three books rely upon Snape functioning in this manner. So in book 5, you have Harry, who's received the fake vision of Sirius being tortured by Voldemort, and is so trying to, if possible, get news to the Order, if not, go to the Ministry himself. And so, under the eyes of Dolores Umbridge, tells Snape he has Padfoot at the place where it's hidden, which to Umbridge is completely and utterly obscure. No idea what Harry is talking about. And so we already have a bit of this hidden element, and it's only because Harry communicated with Snape there that Snape was able to contact the Order, let them know something was going on, which allowed the Order to arrive in time, mostly, for the battle in the Department of Mystery. At the end of Book 6, you have Snape secretly, under Dumbledore's orders, seeming to betray Dumbledore, but actually not, and insofar as he allows the bringing together of the Death Eaters and Dumbledore in that confrontation, acts as this uniting figure. And then finally in Book 7, it is the memories provided by Snape that ultimately unite Harry and Voldemort when Voldemort kills the Death. And it is ultimately a question of actually bringing to light the meaning behind the character of Snape that in the final duel with Voldemort allows Harry to have that victory, tracing the subtle ownership of the Elder One, who owns what.
That is a great reading of Snape. I love that. I think you can even take it back right even to the first book, where you always think Snape is the one behind all the things. He seems like the obvious villain, but then it turns out all of those moments you thought were evidence that he was, you know, helping Voldemort or whatever in retrospect, getting in Harry's way or creating problems or setting the troll loose, all of those things, that Snape is actually the person who's trying to help, and Snape is the one helping to keep Harry up on his broom right at the end of the Quidditch match and all of that. And so the fact that he is such an ambiguous figure allows him to, you know, to be that bridge. He's the double agent, and in some ways that's the key element, if I may use that word. So let's look at the mythic context as it applies to the Cormoran Strike series, because I know, Evan, you have actually written some really excellent pieces at Hogwarts Professor about the mythic imagery and actually some of the stories that are being called upon in the Strike series. Where do we see that? What would you say are like the highlights for somebody who's just trying to see what those links might be?
So the main one here will be the two myths of Leda and the Swan and the Gemini. So, Leda and the Swan, Zeus in the form of the Swan, comes to Leda, a mortal, and she bears a set of twins. One set of twins includes her and Pollux, the Gemini, the twins.
Mm-hmm. Castor and Pollux, right, yeah.
Now, twins in and of themselves act as one of those hints that we should be expecting Hermes to be acting in the background. And this is why we have in Orson his boy Shasta and Corrin, the twins, we have this single meaning doubly displayed, or this double meaning that seems to have some common element between them that unites them.
The idea of twins is maybe one of the things that lets us know that there is some hermetic mythological context, and that we should be looking for that, for like you say, doubles. Where do we see that in Cormoran Strike?
We see the aspects of one of the Gemini, the boxer, in Cormoran himself, and the fact that his mother's name is Leda points to the fact that something about this narrative is in play here. And then we look to see if are there more directly hermetic hidden figures that seem to alternate between the world as hidden and the world as visible. The character of Shankar seems to play very much this Hermes type role. And then part of what I had written in my earlier piece, I had assumed that Rowling was replaying the Orestes myth as she had in the Harry Potter books.
Yeah, this matches up with John's idea that she's, you know, she's kind of replaying Harry Potter and Cormoran Strike, but we could even maybe see that with the myth. So your first instinct was that Harry was, that the Cormoran Strike series was also going to be telling the Orestes myth.
Right. In particular, because the Orestes myth, just in general, in almost all of its versions, is one of the clearest in showing that Hermes is acting behind in the background. I mean, Aeschylus' Libation Bearers, which is epigraph to Deathly Hallows.
Mm-hmm.
That book opens with a prayer to Hermes to, in his role as Lord of the Dead and his role as Psychopomp, to help Orestes avenge his father. He does so Orestes avenges his father by killing his mother, which brings about the wrath of the Furies, who aren't terribly fond of that violation of blood ties. Now, in Aeschylus and the Libation Bearers, this is solved by, actually in the Eumenides, it's solved in a court case where Hermes stands behind the scenes and sneaks sophistical arguments to Apollo to try and get Orestes off, which works, and the Furies are reconciled to Athenian society, democracy is established, the younger generation of gods gain effective control over the cosmos, as opposed to the older order of the Furies and of Zeus, or retributive order. In the Euripides account, rather than have the court case, the Gemini show up and do this reconciliation of opposing forces. And so in the Orestes myth as such, you have the cycle of revenge and the cycle of elder generation of gods being overthrown by younger generations of gods being resolved by Hermes acting in the background. Just off screen, but there are enough hints that he's acting that we get there. So, when it came to Cormoran Strike, we have Rokeby as the Zeus parallel, representing this old order. And so I was thinking, okay, Zeus doesn't appear in the story of Orestes directly, but he's very much representative of all of the problems that the story is trying to represent. So, I didn't expect Rokeby to show up, and I expected that at some point or other there would be a court case in which Strike and one of his brothers representing the Gemini would manage to win and resolve the problem. This was presuming that where we were going was the story of Orestes. I no longer think that we're having a recapitulation of the story of Orestes in the Carmen Strike series. I think what we're getting instead is a retelling of an event that happened in mythology a couple of generations earlier, before the Trojan War, in which the Gemini steal wives from the chaos surrounding it led to the death of one of the Gemini, and then their alternation between Hades and Olympus on a almost day-to-day basis, thus uniting heaven and the afterlife.
So it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the Cormoran Strike series is maybe going back to an earlier time of mythic formulation, so that there's
right.
an earlier set of stories that Cormoran Strike is referencing?
Right. So I think that we should have Cormoran and Robin, who I think play the role of the Gemini very well.
So you're suggesting that Robin might be Cormoran's twin as we're reading this story?
Yep. And so,
cool.
In parallel with the myth, especially in Book 4, we've had Robin and Cormoran steal the other one of them from their respective partners, so from Charlotte and from Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this conflict resulted in myth was a series of conflicts that ultimately led to the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, the parents of Achilles, and whose wedding is mostly notable for including the throwing of the apple of discord that led to the Trojan War. So when it comes to the Cormoran Strike series, I'm predicting that, well, one, we won't see Rokeby and that he's still acting as this image of the old structure that's still maintained, this older generational decadence, and that we should expect that the main antagonist, Matthew and Charlotte, allied against Cormoran.
So if Cormoran and Robin are the twins, then what you're suggesting is that Matthew and Charlotte will maybe ally together, and there'll be a conflict between those two sets.
Absolutely, absolutely. The myth includes a battle between two sets of twins, which is a wonderfully hermetic image.
There's a big image here. You've talked just very briefly about Cormoran and Robin being the Gemini, the Castor and Pollux figures, and that the Pollux figure, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is the boxer with the it was the son of Leda and the of Zeus, and Cormoran as the giant is the son of Leda and Johnny Rokeby, who has kind of this overhanging image in the stories. Castor is the much more human character that has much less of a divine background. But Leda and the king of Sparta are his parents. The genetics here don't work. It's mythological, but these twins have two parents. And Robin, in this respect, is much less the person in charge, at least through the first four books. And she's not a boxer. Castor's famous for his ability with horses. Robin's mentioned that she grew up riding horses, and she has the modern equivalent of being a great driver. And so we see that she's embedded these two inside the story that way. What's fascinating with the whole Castor and Pollux thing is that it has a mythic context with the white horses Rowling really seems to want to make the white horse the big central image of this series. It certainly plays the oversized part in Lethal White. Can you talk about the Leucippides and that mythological background with Castor and Pollux, Evan?
Leucippides is the name of the set of twins that Castor and Pollux end up in conflict with Leucippides, implying this white horse element.
We should be looking for similarities between them and Matthew and Charlotte. And of course, Charlotte is having twins, right? She's pregnant with twins. So there's more twin imagery coming through. J.K. Rowling, never hit that note once when you can hit it 40 times. just to give us some clues.
Seriously, the Shanker is the Hermes. Is a fascinating possibility. There's been a lot of speculation that Shanker is going to be the sacrificial Sirius Black guy in Strike Five, because he plays such an outsized role in Book Three. We're seeing that like Sirius Black does in the Harry Potter series. Maybe he'll die at the end of this. But if Evan's right and Shanker is the hermetic figure, he's got to survive at least until their wedding and the finish. There's also the Black Vanessa, Vanessa Quenzi, who may be the figure who dies in we're looking for
a
Negretto
figure.
I
don't like that either, John.
Just saying. I call her the Black Vanessa because of the Nabokov reference, not to suggest that Vanessa Quenzi's defining characteristic is that she's black. But in terms of the alchemical imagery, yeah, that's a big part of it. This mythological context gives us, that Rowling has been working not only with, Harry Potter as Orestes in that drama, but now we've got this Castor and Pollux thing going on. Louise Freeman asked me about the Christian imagery and the alchemical stuff inside Cormoran Strike, and I was saying it's a lot more subtle. There's a lot less black, white and red things inside here. A lot less, characters aren't named Hermione and such. But we don't get, the obvious stuff that we got in Harry Potter. But we're seeing, as Evan points out, through this mythological imagery, the same kind of layered structure that has there's a mythic context. A guy named Northrop Frye wrote a wonderful book called The Anatomy of Criticism long ago, largely to advance sort of an archetypal perspective on literature. And he said that really there's a spectrum of story, and you start off on one side, it's just realistic, where I'm just telling a story and you can tell the color of his toenails and what the weather is and how whether he used deodorant that morning, and it's just horribly realistic. And the other side is the mythological, otherworldly story that has almost no relationship, no connection to the way we live our lives. And on that spectrum, there should be a crossing over point where that what's realistic gives you entry into the mythological. And Harry Potter hits that mean almost perfectly, where you really do believe that there's people out there with wands and robes and they're going to school, and it all seems very commonplace. Magic becomes nothing very unusual inside the stories, and Rowling through that gives us this mythological alchemical experience of transformation that Fry and others say is really the end of story. She's trying to do the same thing with Cormoran Strike, where, Evan just mentioned this very briefly, that, Cormoran is the name of a giant and Strike is the name of a boxer. She's giving it, someone who strikes. That's giving us this Castor and Pollux backdrop. And the big thing that Castor and Pollux do is they break up this marriage of the Leucippides, and their partners come back in for revenge. So what we're looking at, if she continues to follow this Castor and Pollux mythological model, is that Matthew, whose wife was taken, he feels, by Cormoran, and almost certainly really was. And I mean, he shouldn't have allowed them to get married. And then Charlotte, who's going to imagine that Robin always had designs on Strike and that she's the biggest block to her getting back together with her beloved Cormoran, is that there's going to be a joining of forces between, you know, I think Cormoran's phrase is batshit insane. His ex, Charlotte Campbell Ross, and Matthew, who I think we see at Robin's departure, has gone around the twist, that he's going to be absolutely destroyed in his business, in his house, his reputation in his home village. Everything's going to be destroyed by his divorce from Robin, and that he's going to, you know, live to work his revenge on that. And in the mythology, they win. You know, they actually do wind up, you know, killing the mortal caster, which leads to their sort of otherworldly existence as the Gemini constellation. If Rowling is following this model, things don't look good for Robin.
John, this is bad. I don't like these predictions that you're throwing around here. I guess the myths, you're not looking for, like, everybody, you know, everybody wants
Rowling,
happily.
And that's right. And Rowling reunites them. So something I want to go back to is in Evan's really brilliant posts on Hogwarts Professor, he sets this, you know, it all comes from that Escalin epigraph for the book Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and the William Penn piece. They're paired there. And Rowling said that she chose those epigraphs very early in the writing of the series. And she said, if I get to the last book and those two epigraphs are still relevant, still are what I'm talking about, then I'm on track with what I wanted to do. So those are really seminal things there. And sure enough, if you look at that thing, as Evan points out in his blog post on mythic context at Hogwarts Professor, that post is really about the Hermes figure. And the Penn post is about what Ward calls the Kappa element. Kappa is the, you know, the Greek letter K. And the reason that Lewis chooses the Kappa letter for what he's talking about, this secret thing, is that the Greek word he's talking about is krypton, which we recognize from, you know, the bad stuff that makes Superman, you know, weak, but kryptonite. But krypton is the Greek word for secret. Yeah, that the reason they use that for Superman is because it's his secret weakness. But that or his secret origin is the planet Krypton. Now, that secret element inside Harry Potter and alchemical literature is this Hermes figure that is working behind the scenes. Usually he's kind of a nasty person. You know, Hermes is a cattle thief, you know, and all sorts of as a god. That's how he gets all of his powers. He steals things. And that figure inside the story is, as Evan has really, I think, you know, brilliantly laid out, is Severus Snape. It's Severus Snape plays this guy that you don't know which side he's on. And yet it turns out he's the person who's actually uniting and writing the story in the background. He's really the hermetic author of the story. In Cormoran Strike, we don't have the big bad guy figure like Voldemort, and we don't have, you know, the sort of crazy whose side is he on figure like Snape. But we do have Shanker, who's a messenger, a deliverer, a guy that's on both sides of the law.
He's between worlds. He's got an underworld personality, but then he can also interact with, you know, Robin.
that's right. And I mean, he loves Leda, but he's scary, dangerous. You know, that Strike is like, don't leave anything around here when Shanker's here, because he'll steal it. You know, I mean, he loves his adoptive brother, but he knows exactly what he is. That hermetic figure inside the story is very different than Severus Snape. You know, but then again, maybe he's going to take on a much larger role in the next book. Forgive me here, Katie, if he survives, if he's this hermetic figure that's telling the story, one, it'll be much harder to kill him, and two, he's going to have to play a part in revealing, you know, what really happened at Leda. Because remember, Strike goes off to Oxford, and Shanker, one of the reasons he goes off to Oxford is that Shanker is still living with Leda and her bonkers, you know, younger husband. And Strike feels safe leaving them together. We haven't learned at all what happened. That you know, we do know that Shanker went off to make a drug deal, and he came back, and Leda was dead. But there had to have been something else that was going on that Shanker knows about, because he says at the trial that bastard did it. You know, he tries to come out of the testifying box in a British court and grab the accused of the crime. Now that makes him, again, you know, he can't even be trusted to testify. He's going to take justice into his own hands. He's the perfect hermetic figure. Will we learn in the next book all that he knows? Maybe that's going to be, because for example, we don't get that much Sirius Black in Prisoner of Azkaban. He doesn't really appear until the very end of the story, and it's all very exciting, but that's really basically our introduction to him. We don't really get to know Sirius Black until the House of Black scenes in Order of the Phoenix. And he has an interview in Goblet of Fire too, but we don't get to know Strike very well until Order of the Phoenix, the book in which he dies. I'm hoping that Shanker will not only survive, but that we'll learn a whole lot more about what he knows in this underworld that he's lived in, to include Leda Strike's death, you know, where she lived, what she was doing, and this kind of thing. Back to Louise Freeman's questions. Hey, John, where's the alchemical symbolism? You know, where's the Christian symbolism inside these books? If we're talking about parallels with Harry Potter, it's a lot more subtle, but it's in the mythology. You know, that she's giving us these layered readings taken from mythology. I think she didn't want to write a book that was as obviously and powerfully Christian as the one. Who knows if that was just burnout from the whole Potter panic experience. But the Cormoran Strike stories are still mythological and carry that mythic, anagogical backdrop that the Harry Potter stories do.
That's so cool. And I just love all of the, when I'm reading Cormoran Strike, I mean, it's got so many details just in the detective story that you're following that I forget about the other, you know, the other literary elements. And then when I hear, you know, you and Evan talking about, you know, these other stories that are, you know, being this Cormoran Strike stories is being laid atop these mythic stories, and we're supposed to see them kind of bleeding through. I think, you know, wow, that just, it makes you want to reread them. And of course, rereading is one of the the things we're supposed to do with J.K. Rowling works, right?
Yeah. Here's the fun thing. I think that this conversation gives a different answer to the question is, you know, what happened to J.K. Rowling? Where did she go?
You know, as we were thinking about what we wanted to talk about today, one of your questions is, has Rowling sort of embraced being the, you know, present power of the seemingly absent? Is she trying to be seemingly absent? Is she being a hermetic figure herself and kind of going quiet like this? What do y'all think?
As to becoming a hermetic figure, I think she definitely very consciously recognizes that the role of an author itself is almost always a hermetic one, because you're precisely what the audience doesn't see, but that you're also the only one that's ever actually saying anything. And it's the author that brings together all the characters as needed, etc. That also allows her to do fun things in her books, like allow for the possibility of truly meaningful sequences of events, which I suspect is how her author avatar, Trelawney, actually manages to make such good prophecies.
Yeah,
because There's a Hermes figure behind there enabling that.
That's perfect, because Trelawney almost certainly is a rolling character embedded inside the thing, because we know that when she was in high school, she used to do tarot card readings and astrological readings for her friends as a lark, as a joke. Basically, she would play the new age crazy figure, but she would actually use astrological and tarot card readings to do it. So they were entertained, but they were also kind of startled at how good she was at it. And so Rowling takes that, that jokey figure that she was in high school, and makes it the French teacher from Schoolboy Literature. There's always a goofy French teacher that everybody laughs at. She puts herself in there as Trelawney. But as Evan says, hey, without Trelawney, we don't have the prophecy, the core text inside the text that drives everything going on inside the text comes from Trelawney. There's something to her that suggests that way. And Corwin Strike, we also get embedded figures, especially in the most important book in the series, which is The Silkworm. It was the first book that she wrote. It's really what the series is about. It's a book about story. You're reading a book called The Silkworm, and inside the novel, the characters are reading Bombyx Mori, which is a novel called The Silkworm. That mirror imaging is going on not only that way, but the murderer turns out to be a frustrated woman author, and there's a character, Catherine Kent, inside the books that is a sort of a Rowling wannabe figure. What Rowling would have been like if she hadn't had the phenomenal success that she had with Harry Potter. This argues that Rowling's education in mythology from Steve Eddy through the University of Exeter and her own study of these things. I mean, she's clearly very familiar with Orestes and Hermes's place, especially in the Euripides Electress, version of that story. And she's consciously, writing hermetic figures and playing the role herself. And that's the fun possibility about the Twitter silence. She finally just said, hey, wait a minute. Why don't I do Severus Snape here and just disappear? People are saying all sorts of horrible things about me. Why don't I raise my brand by going silent? That's what an author does, is not so much be the public figure until they have to promote their books. If it gives us more stories, I'm all for it. Yeah. I know that a lot of people miss her sense of humor on the Twitter feed. I think she may have realized, hey, I'm exerting all this effort and I'm not moving the elephant of British politics more to center left than it was before. All those people that are already persuaded are already persuaded, and my Twittering and retweeting is only, preaching to the choir, silence.
And when she started Twitter, I think she had said, I'm never going to be on here. And then Twitter, like a lot of social media, it pulls you in. And it may be that she's kind of recognized, oh, maybe it was better to be, more in the background, and going back to her original intention.
Well, I have to, my wife served that conscience thing for me. I was about ready to jump into Facebook and Twitter and all the social media stuff. And my wife said, if you're in this for more than a week, you'll be in a 12-step program. There's just no way that you can get one foot in there. You're going to go heart, soul, mind, and strength. And no, you're not going to do that. And praise God that she did say that for me. She handles, Hogwarts professor does some Twittering and social media stuff, but it's all done by somebody else. It's not done by John.
Yeah, it's very, I think it does pull you in. I mean, that's the whole point of it. I can lose a lot of time that way. So I have to watch it for myself too. One of the things we have not talked about yet is the other thing that Rowling is working on, which is the Fantastic Beasts series. And we know that the latest movie date was pushed back. The release date was pushed back. And we've speculated a little bit about why that might be. But she does still seem to be involved in the writing of it. And we've got to have some kind of, mythic and or alchemical, overlay happening in the Fantastic Beasts series, too. So some ideas about what might be happening in Fantastic Beasts alchemically or mythically.
The general sense I've been getting has been variants on the Theseus myth, which puts it well before in the mythological chronology of things, the settings we've seen in other Rowling works.
So what you're saying, just in terms of the mythic context, like what you were talking about with Cormoran Strike, that maybe that's an earlier story. You think that the Fantastic Beasts, because it's drawing on Theseus, is maybe even an older story than that?
It is. A handful of images, less plot points, but handful of images from the Theseus myth. So there's this one bit in the Theseus myth where late in his life ends up having friends that get him into all sorts of trouble, and descends into the underworld to try and help his friend steal Persephone. This doesn't go well, and Theseus ends up ends up stuck in a chair in the underworld for a good portion of time. There's at least one scene in the last one where you have Theseus, Scamander, very much tied to a chair, which I think is a subtle reference to that. But as to the structure of it, I'm not seeing the alchemical structural underlying bit yet on those. I suspect, rather than a mythological backdrop, there is more of a literary backdrop. Dumbledore Grindelwald, that relationship was always fairly clear as paralleling that of Basil and Dorian in Oscar Wilde's Picture of Dorian Gray. So I suspect that a close analysis of Dorian Gray would provide a bit of guidance on what we might expect from Fantastic Beasts. Dorian Gray also being notable for including a Horcrux in the painting itself.
I've done some work with the alchemy, and most of it is with an analysis of a picture that they released early on in the promotions for Crimes of Grindelwald that had Grindelwald and Dumbledore on the left and right of the picture, and then four couples in the center. And the four couples represent the four elements, and the quarreling couple are clearly the Mercurial Grindelwald and the sulfuric Grindelwald and the Mercurial Dumbledore, who's in the background manipulating people. He can't get actually engaged in the thing. So if there's a hermetic figure inside this story, it's Dumbledore. As Evan said, it's hard to tell in these films what Rowling is doing, because there's pieces we don't have. My hope is that we'll see more. We see the alchemical imagery. We see the dragon and the phoenix images, which are alchemical images. We have Newt, who's really the fiery the character on fire here. That's the phoenix is rejuvenated by fire. The dragon has fire within that it breathes out as a weapon. And Newt lives in the fire. I mean, these are alchemical images that Rowling is talking about. The beast within is really the fantastic beast of the story, rather than these funny creatures that are CGI, monsters. That's what the story is about. And so there's alchemy in there, but I don't know, between the cuts they make to her story that we can't tell, how bad that is, though we're suspicious that it's very bad. And the actual medium itself. And that's what I don't get, is how do you do literary alchemy or literary uses of alchemy, mythic or metallurgical? How do you use that in a medium that really is not imaginative? You're getting straight sense perception here.
And John, I just think this raises a crucial question. We talked about literary alchemy in the world of, play writing and play going. And then we see it in the act of reading. But is there something about films where it's not gonna pull on us? It's not gonna affect that transformation the same way because the film does so much of the imaginative work for you. What do you think? I mean, is the film not going to be able to by itself convey the alchemical images, or do you think? I mean, we've only seen two, so is it coming? What do you think?
Well, we have the experience of the 8 Harry Potter films.
But there were books. They started as books, right? So they didn't have to do all that work of alchemy themselves.
That's the critical thing. I mean, I've said on Hogwarts Professor, you know, that what we really hope happens here is that Warner Brothers said, hey, we had a winning formula, and that winning formula is you write a novel, girl, and we adapt it for a movie, and we got it. Yeah, and that's how this works. And that Rowling has gone silent because she's writing up those first two screenplays novels, and then we're going to get the novels before we get the films.
Now, John, that is a prediction I would love to come true. please.
Yeah. I mean, that's that. Of course, it'd be kind of funny because if she writes these stories up, we're going to find out all the stuff that they murdered and slashed from the films. But so it's not likely to happen. But. And Rowling has said she's not writing any more of these books as novels. So, you know. Oh, anyway, but that's the hope for thing. It's for me, the agony of the films is that no one's life, forgive me, I've never met a person whose life was changed by film. That films, you know, confirm you in beliefs that you already have, or they make you distinctly uncomfortable. And then you walk out of the theater and you go have a soda or an ice cream sundae and you forget about it. An imaginative experience, either in a stage setting, a live stage setting, or imaginative reading, that transforms lives all the time because it involves the engagement of a different faculty of human understanding, you know, the imagination. Yeah,
well, and you know, John, I mean, I do think there are people who will tell you that their lives were changed by a film that they saw. And so, and I bet some of our listeners might be thinking right now of my life was changed by this particular film. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I do think that's possible. But I think it's legitimate to wonder whether the alchemical symbolism and the alchemical nature of the transformation can be delivered in the same way through that medium. And maybe they're just not there. They might be changing people with a different engine.
Maybe people that have grown up with this visual sense oriented medium, that's how their imagination is engaged, but it's a much lesser engagement of that faculty. And that faculty that Coleridge clearly links with, that the imagination is clearly linked with the logos within us, perceptive faculty that's continuous with the fabric of reality, you know, the capital lambda logos, that idea, that's what makes alchemy possible. That's what makes the alchemy of literature possible. And that's what makes imaginative literature and stage drama so powerful, is because that faculty, which is where we can actually change, that's where that faculty is engaged. It's not engaged in our schools. It's not engaged in our entertainments as a rule. It's which have all been reduced to sense perception. This is where the alchemy of literature happens. If it happens in film, it happens because that faculty is tangentially engaged along with sense perception. But it's clearly so much less than it, we can see that. And we were just joking, you know, we want the story. We want her to write the novels so we can have that experience imaginatively. And then we'll have the film thing for fun. But in terms of real change and engagement with the story, we want the book. And those people that only want the films, that faculty within them is atrophied to the point where they don't even, it's for them, reading is just difficult work and they don't want to do that. That's the real split in fandom, I think, is between the people that came in that really identify with the films and those people that still think of Harry Potter really almost exclusively as a literary phenomenon.
Yeah, and I wondered the degree to which it's the, you know, the films, you know, when they're looking for things to cut, they're going to cut some of the alchemical stuff. right? So the just the
the
economy of the film, it just doesn't have time to do some of the groundwork and the, you know, the layering of stories and symbols that J.K. Rowling has done in her written works. They just, so they're gonna end up nixing some of those things, and that appears to be what's happening in Fantastic Beasts. Perhaps we don't really know, but we might guess. Hermes is he doesn't have a powerful presence despite being absent. He's just absent, maybe. I don't know.
I mean, as Evan points out in his written work, and here we were in our conversation, the Hermes figure has to be someone who divides first and then unites kind of secretly. Mm-hmm. This Hermetic figure has to be ambiguous, has to be at least bipolar. You know, there has to be something. Do you really get in the films that Dumbledore could possibly be an ally of Grindelwald?
No.
They cut the scene where the Ministry of Magic is saying, hey, this is a real possibility. And you know, in a character that we like, Theseus, and we see Theseus as being conflicted, you know, which way to go here. But we don't get Dumbledore realistically presented as a guy who could be still on Grindelwald's side.
Hey, but what about, here's what just occurred to me, John. How about Queenie?
Could Queenie
be hermetic here? Because she looks like she's gone over. She's dividing,
right.
But then she'll unite. I don't know. That makes
a lot of sense. I mean, is she the principal figure there? She doesn't play that larger role in this. I mean, well, I don't know. Evan, what do you think? Could Queenie be the hermetic figure for the?
Ultimately, where this whole plot is going is the unification in the duel between Dumbledore and Grindelwald. Mm-hmm. That's where it ends up. That's where it all resolves. So we know that we have that unification of opposites in conflict at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to look at what are those elements that are operating behind the scenes, where almost no one can see it, that enables this ultimate unification and battle where Grindelwald is defeated. Just off the top of my head, in the last film, one thing I think they did well in this type of symbolism, the Niffler stealing the blood pact.
Yeah.
Such a minor scene that you'd barely notice it unless you were looking for it. And at the same time, that's the sort of thing that will allow sufficient division of Dumbledore and Grindelwald, which to some degree has already happened with their falling out before the opening of the series, that will then enable that reconciliation. I'm more in favor of film as potential vehicle for alchemical conflicts than I think John is.
Okay. You think it's
possible? That wouldn't be hard.
No, that's true.
I represent the hard Coleridge side of the spectrum. But Newt clearly is supposed to be the bridge. He may be the hermetic figure, though he's right up in front, where he has to somehow bridge the divide between Grindelwald the dragon and Dumbledore the phoenix. And mm-hmm. this will take place, you know, over Credence's body and identity. Who is he? Is he a Dumbledore? Is he a Grindelwald? What is he? Mm-hmm. Newt as the hermetic figure, because he's the creature that lives in flame, just as the phoenix is revived and the dragon embodies the fire. Newt is this kind of bridge figure. But if Newt's never really confused, I mean, at the end of the second film, he says, "I've chosen my sides." That's the transformation in Newt. In the beginning of the film, he says, "I don't do sides. I don't change sides." At the end, he says, "I've chosen my side," meaning I've just saved the city of Paris from this madman's attempt to blow it up. I'm on the side against him. Then he has the Niffler thing. He has the means to free Dumbledore from Grindelwald. to divide those two, and eventually, they'll be united, and their resolution, their polarity will be resolved in battle. As we know, these films really have to end with the battle between Grindelwald and Dumbledore.
I mean, I do think just reminding ourselves also of the endpoint that we already know, as Evan said, is a really good boundary for our speculations. it helps keep us disciplined as we're doing that. Well, Evan, let me end with a question just for you, based on your analysis and your sense of Rowling as an alchemical and mythic writer. What are you most interested in seeing forthcoming from Rowling's works? Are you interested to see the Fantastic Beasts direction, or is that the Cormoran Strikes, or are there particular characters or moments that you're looking forward to seeing resolved? What are you most excited about?
Probably the Cormoran Strike stuff, seeing how just that structure develops, seeing where I'll need to revise what I thought again. It will happen. But the Fantastic Beasts series as well, seeing we can better pin down what literary sources she's using, what she's structuring it by.
We all do what Harry did when he opened up Riddle's diary and fell into the story.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all manipulated by the author, just as Riddle manipulates Harry inside his own diary. We're all manipulated by the author. We want, that magical experience writ large inside our reading experience. That's why fantasy novels outsell everything but romance in publishing, is because people want that magical Coleridgean transformative experience to circle around to the beginning here, we'll pretend this is a ring here. That there's alchemical literature that the alchemists write. There's the literary alchemy or literary uses of alchemy that writers use that. And the reason they do that is because of the alchemy of literature. The reason that Cormoran Strike is a fail in many respects in terms of its popularity is the alchemy is so subtle and the symbolism is so much that the readers don't get that transformative experience. They don't really enter into the text as fully as they would if it were a magical book. And the films, both the Harry Potter films and the Fantastic Beasts films, they fail because they're films. That it's very, very difficult to enter into something imaginatively that you're experiencing by actual sense perception. Even if it's projected onto a screen and it's not real, it's like Plato's cave. It's more a matter of being hypnotized than it is of entering into something imaginatively.
Yeah, but I do think that's the theme of our whole podcast here is the power of literature. And my closing quote is always about the importance of really the word. Well, thank you so much, Evan Willis, for being on the podcast today. I feel like we have learned a lot. There are a lot of cast back to 10th grade English, which might be the last time I did Greek mythology in any kind of way. And I certainly did not do it at the level that you're talking about. So how stimulating to be able to hear from you. Thank you, Evan, for helping us to see the especially mythic stories and symbolism that Rowling is drawing on in all of her creative work.
Thanks for having me.
And I know also, Evan, that you've been very influential to John, and thanks, John, to you too for, of course, connecting us up with literary alchemy, but as always, for being our expert guest. Thanks, John.
You're very kind. I need to say that, Evan, you'll be featured in my PhD thesis. I'm writing this Coleridge stuff up, and really the mythological context of alchemy, which I've been largely blind to, you've been a great light to me in that. So you'll be more than footnotes, Evan, in my thesis.
The greatest compliment of all.
Wow, thanks.
That's awesome. I'd also like to give a big thank you to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Emma, thank you so much for everything that you do. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and Lori Beckoff, our MuggleNet liaison and producer. Now, speaking of which, dear listeners, we are so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would join our conversation by leaving a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And John particularly has given you lots of things to respond to about the movies. If you want to talk about film and alchemy, I know I would be really interested to hear people's thoughts about that. Now, listeners, I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, a great alchemist figure in the Harry Potter books. He said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.